This is an ABC podcast.
Wendy Harmer has lived multiple lives as a comedian, a radio host, a children's author, and a playwright. Wendy lives in a nice house near the beach with her lovely family. None of this was preordained. It's the result of titanic talent and struggle and fierce ambition. Wendy Harmer grew up in country Victoria. She's the daughter of a school teacher. There was very little money. She was born with a cleft palate that wasn't properly surgically repaired until she was in her mid-teens. They moved from town to town, and because there was no mum around for a long while, Wendy had to be a kind of surrogate mum herself. After a stint as a journalist, Wendy became a conquering female stand-up comedian and a TV host at a time when the scene was, to say the least, very blokey. As a breakfast radio presenter, Wendy regularly topped the ratings for years and years. The woman is a bloody rocket. Full disclosure, I've known Wendy for many, many years. We've been friends since the 1980s. We even went to each other's weddings. But I have never really talked to Wendy in all those years about her early life and how she got from there to here. Hello, Wendy. Welcome to you.
Hello, Richard. Thank you for all that. I'm a bit tired now.
Let's have a light down. For an hour would be about right, wouldn't it?
Oh, yes,
we'll come good after an hour, won't we?
Yeah, we will. We will.
Your parents, how old were they when you came along? They were pretty young, weren't they?
Oh, they were, yes. Dad was 23, Mum was 17, and she proceeded to have four kids under six. I was born with a double cleft palate and lip, and my younger brother, Noel, was also born with a cleft lip.
What's a double cleft palate?
Oh, well, you end up not just with a split in your lip there, you end up sort of with a hole in your face, probably about the size of a golf ball or something. And the roof of your mouth hasn't formed properly, and your top lip hasn't formed properly. And the reason that they used to call it in the old days a hare lip is because you kind of look like a rabbit. You know, you've got that top lip like a rabbit. Mm-hmm. And the reason that the term a hare lip was used was in old days, they used to believe that a pregnant woman, if she gave birth to someone with that defect, that a hare had run in front of her across the road and bewitched the child in her belly. So that's how we come up with the word hare lip.
So that was you. You were tainted by Satan from birth, were you?
I was. And rabbits, and my brother kept ferrets, and they've just been recurring in my life theme.
What did that mean when you were born, how your parents responded and the doctors responded when it was obvious that you'd had this double cleft palate, Wendy?
Well, Dad very helpfully said on Australian Story many years later, he said, oh, if she was a dog, you would have drowned her. But luckily we loved that kid. Oh, I was sitting there watching this going, oh, crikey, thanks, Dad. You know, a country man through and through.
Plain speaking, hey?
Yes, he used to breed dogs. Right. So, you know, I think that's... And Mum, you know, she said, she remembers looking at me and thought, oh, you're going to need a lot of help in this world, little one. So that's how that went for them. Oh, I think a really big burden for them in, you know, country Victoria. We were living, as I say, I was born in Yarram and Dad was teaching a little school in Tarraville in Gippsland on the coast there. There was a lot of to and fro from hospital, you know, from all the way to Melbourne and back, which was a long trip. And then we moved to a little place called Warncourt, which is in the Western District, the place of many bandicoots.
Right.
And another little school there where there were only about sort of 20 kids in the whole school. And then Mum had these, you know, this brood of kids. So I think it was a very difficult time for her.
You know, kids blame themselves for everything that goes wrong. It takes you a long while to realise that. It's funny, isn't it?
Mm.
Kids, for things that are completely not their fault in any way. Did you somehow tell yourself that you were a burden to your parents?
No. Oh, no, I didn't. I didn't ever feel that. Because I was so close to my brothers and sister and we were such a little gang and I wasn't judged by them, and every time a kid at school would try to pick on me, they'd go around and belt them So yeah. I always felt sort of very protected by my brothers and sisters. So I kind of, the weirdest thing, I almost had the opposite, Richard. I grew up with the idea that just by concentrating, I could make things happen. I could change the world around me.
Really? Where did you get that idea from?
I don't know. I've got no idea. I just thought I can change my circumstances just if I concentrate hard enough.
What advice did your parents give you about being bullied about your cleft palate?
Well, yeah, it was... Well, I'll tell you by telling you a little story. So I was about 8 years old and I had come home from school and I'd said to my mum, all the kids are picking on me. A flat face and eagle beak and, you know, all these sorts of names. And she said, Wendy, I want you to go into that bedroom and look in the mirror. And when you find something to complain about, you come out and tell me. Well, of course, there was plenty to complain about. I mean, I looked like one of those cartoon characters that's walked into a door, you know. I had this really crooked lip and teeth every way and a completely flat nose. And so I just stood there for a long time and I looked and looked. And then I went out and told my mother, I can't find anything to complain about. And she said, exactly. So let's just get on with it.
What do you think about that advice?
Stupid, in some ways, because, you know, it's kind of a lie. I think we've come a long way since then where they say, you know, you've got whatever affliction it might be. Oh, you'll be fine. You'll cope. I could not do that to my kids. I don't think, would you do that to your kids? I think parenting's really changed. I think, yes, resilience is important. Yes, being given the armoury to be able to stand up to the slings and arrows is important. But I think, in my particular case, I think it was too tough. It was too tough. And years later too, I mean, my dad, I said, why did you push me like that? And he said, I thought it would be really good for you. I thought it would work for you, but I think I was too tough. So I think in some ways both of them were too tough on me and I would have liked a little more compassion and succour than I got. My mother was... In some way, she was, you know, physically abusive at times to me. There's a story of her leaving and then me not seeing her for quite a few years. And one of the first things that I said to her was, why did you used to hit me? And she said, because you were strong and I knew you could take it. I was just born strong. I don't know why. I think a little indomitable spirit and I don't know really where that comes from.
You've always
but
told
I'm
me...
But I'm glad I...
Yeah, I'm glad you have
glad
it too.
I was like that.
You've always told me you never liked the name Wendy. Why not?
Oh, it's wet, really, because it sounds like, oh, hi, can I come too? No, you can't, Wendy. You've got to stay here with Timmy the dog and mind the picnic.
Yeah, but Wendy flies off with Peter Pan and has a marvellous adventure, doesn't she?
I asked my mother how I got the name Wendy, and I thought it would be this magical story of, yes, exactly, Wendy darling and Peter Pan. And I said, well, so how did you, why did you name me Wendy? She said, oh, I was knitting a pattern at the time, a layette, and it was called Wendy. And I thought, oh, well, that was a nice name. So I'm actually named after a knitting pattern, Richard.
Right. So we have Butterix to thank for, for your name.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you started your own neighbourhood newspapers as a kid.
Yeah. Well, as a kid, I guess the logical thing that I would probably have wanted to do when I grew up was be a teacher like Dad. And so that would have been this thing. But
that was the closest thing to being an intellectual and a knowledge worker in country Victoria.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Dad remembers the time he used to always lament. He said, oh, I remember when the teacher used to be the king of the town. Everyone respected him and he ran the school with an iron rod. Now parents have too much, you know, so it was a bit like that. But I wanted to be a journalist. I have got no idea why either. What I decided to do was make a little country newspaper. By this time, we had moved to Selby in the Dandenongs. And so I wrote the neighbourhood newspaper. Like, I had a great front page story. It's like, next door neighbours get power on, you know, things like that. And, you know, the opening paragraph, the lights went on at the Dutez house last night at 8 p.m. to the surprise and astonishment of neighbours. You know, it would be like that. Anyway.
So it was just typed or handwritten.
Right.
And did you colour in the headlines and all that?
Yeah, and I hand-drew all the photographs, you know. And
was there a price in the upper right-hand corner?
Of course there was. It was a red top. But anyway, I got closed down by a terrible set of circumstances. One of the neighbours next door, I found out from, you know, one of the kids that their dad had been arrested for drink driving. I thought, well, here's a story. Fantastic story.
I want to hear about that.
So the headline went something like, Roy, drunk, driving truck, hits fence. Arrest made. And anyway, so I've hand done this. I would hand do about like 9 copies and hand them around the neighbourhood. Anyway, next minute, front door, Roy, can I see your father, please? And so I was put out of business.
Right. Hang on, this is a free country, Wendy. It's not a Stalinist totalitarian state, you know. You can't just shut down the press like that.
That's exactly
telling
right.
the truth. You got in trouble for telling the truth.
I did. And it remains so to this day, Richard. I've been having people trying to suppress me for years. I don't know whether it'd be punched down in the face, but I think it went pretty close anyway.
Oh, you mentioned there your mum left.
Mm.
What brought that about, do you think?
Well, you know, mum's never really told me exactly, you know, all the circumstances why, and dad's never really told me exactly either. But I know, you know, there'd been a lot of argument in the house. You could hear, you know, all of that. And I remember one day my mother, she called us into the bedroom and she said, if I don't wake up, call Daddy. And she gave us some money to spend up the shops. So she'd taken something, obviously. And I remember it was a good amount of money too. And so I just remember us going up to the corner shop and the other kids are racing ahead of me. I can see it, you know, in me right now, racing up to the corner shop to buy a whole lot of lollies. And me just kind of traipsing on behind, going, there's something not right about this, really. And then the next image I have is of my father carrying my mother to the car, and I didn't see her again for 6 years, really. I didn't really spend time with her for another 6 years. So, yeah, that was really hard.
Where did she go?
She went to Tasmania. She went back to Tassie, where she was from, and she's stayed there ever since. And we're really good, you know, we're good mates now, we're good friends, and I think the hardship of leaving 4 children, and my little sister was 6, that's never left her. It's been, you know, really hard for her.
After she left, what did that mean for the household?
Well, Dad went right off the rails, you know. He started drinking and he would even be away for weekends and there'd be the 4 of us there. And sometimes there was no food in the house, really. I remember a dinner of Wheat Bix with Vegemite on them and things like that, where I was looking after the, you know, the other ones. And there was one weekend where the men from the department store roll up and took the furniture away because it was on hire purchase and Dad wasn't paying the bills. And so I remember kind of running down the front into the street going, well, you can't take out. And they came in and they took away the bedroom suites and the this and that and the other thing. That was pretty traumatic.
With mum gone and dad not coping too well, were you at risk of being taken away by social services?
Well, we were. I mean, but the thing was that dad, it wasn't, I don't know whether the social services had said it, but dad certainly said to us, if you don't, to the 4 of us, if you don't pull together, I'm going to have to send you to an orphanage and you'll be separated. And so we just stuck together, the four of us, and we were a little fierce team. Yeah, I took the, I remember learning to, oh, I could iron one of Dad's shirts in 1.5 minutes. And I used to, you know, we have his school shirts and I would be there and practice ironing these shirts until I got them perfect and I could do them in record time.
Gee, I bet you hate to iron a shirt and eat a Weet-Bix these days, though. I bet you can't go near a Weet-Bix.
That's it. But we did have a stepmother come along a few years later, but that was, well, it wasn't really all that easy either. I mean, she started out as a housekeeper and then Dad and she took up as a couple. That had its own sort of problems as well. But I can really see how it was very difficult to her, for her to walk in into a household with these four kids who'd been sort of feral for a few years and fiercely independent and then try and sort of, you know, create some order. Because when Dad went off the rails there, he really went off the rails. There was a time there when he was out drinking and he used to stay out drinking, but he would also have these wild parties at our house. And he fell in with a really bad crowd. And there would just be people just rampaging through our house till sort of 4 o'clock in the morning. And we would barricade ourselves in the bedroom sometimes. They'd be banging on the door, wanting just to get up. And then we would get up in the morning and the floors would be strewn with broken glass and bottles. And then we'd just have to get ourselves to school and Dad would have to get himself to school. So when I say that things were off the rails for a while, they really were off the rails. So when our stepmother, Alison, came along, she, as I say, put the house to order.
You said early on you decided you could change the world with your mind.
Mm.
If you always wanted to escape that, the poverty and hardship of those early years?
Yeah. It has been an enormous sense of pride to me that by living on my wits that I have been able to buy a house and I have a very nice house and I have a fridge. I have my own refrigerator and I have two TVs and I have a freezer, you know, all that kind of thing. That has really meant something to me, probably maybe much more than it would have had I been brought up in a really, you know, secure situation. I suppose there's really nothing like someone, you know, taking away your furniture when you're a kid for you to think, wow, I own a couch and no one is going to come and take that couch. I don't think I've really still gotten over that.
Your husband, Brendan, comes from a much more stable family.
It does, yeah.
Do you marvel at that when you see that in him?
He went off to boarding school when he was quite young, so he was quite used to sort of coping himself. But I remember, Richard, you will remember, of course, for years I dined out doing stand-up and, you know, my act was all about, oh, I can't find a husband,
Treacherous men.
You know, all that. Yeah. This is the story. I remember sitting once at my agent's place, having a dinner with a very, you know, smart crowd. And I was probably having a whinge as usual. And one of the guests there, who was a very sort of a wise old owl, he said, I'm going to tell you something. He says, if you ever meet someone and they tell you they have an unhappy childhood, he said, just run away. Just run away as fast as you can. And I thought, well, that was a really strange thing because I had been bonding with all these men who'd had unhappy childhoods. But then I met Brendan, who had a completely, you know, brilliantly happy childhood. And it was kind of, I don't know, in a strange way, it's what I needed. I don't think
that... Just as well that person never spoke to Brendan, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, because he might have run a mile from you.
Yeah, well, it's very weird advice, yeah. Isn't it? But it kind of worked for me. And the thing that really worked for me when I met Brendan was he said, I will be loyal to you. I will never, ever leave you, because I've got all these abandonment issues, of course, and I will follow you around like a faithful old dog till the day you die. And I'm like, oh, what am I taking on? And he said, you should know that. Before you get hooked up with me, you take me on, I am never going anywhere. You understand that? And I thought, shoot, that sounds like a pretty good deal for me. And so that's been very restorative.
I want to go back now because it was, like I said, you were in your mid-teens when you had that reconstructive, was it reconstructive? What would you call it? The facial surgery, in other words.
Yeah.
What did that mean when you got on the bus the next day to go to school?
Oh, wow. Well, I had this big operation where part of my bottom lip was sewn upside down into my top lip. But so the graft could take, I had to have my mouth sewn together. Now, don't you start.
I didn't say anything.
Don't you start.
I'm giggling like a schoolgirl, but I'm not saying anything.
And anyway, so there was a time there that I went home with my mouth sewn together in the middle like that.
How many times have you told that story in some stupid magazine? Oh, wish they kept it down, Jack. Has that happened?
So you just did it.
I know, but I was quoting now.
Yeah, I caught you. Anyway, so, but I went home and my brothers and, mate, Philip and Noel and Helen, they learnt how to push a twisty into one corner. There, so I was very appreciative of that.
So you weren't deprived of twisties throughout this ordeal.
That's right.
There was the
which
least
was
bad.
Which was important. So anyway, so after a good...
Because you can screw them in, can't you? Yeah. They've got a bit of a taper on them. And,
you can. Absolutely.
And a thread. Right.
That's it. You can just push you in there. Anyway, so I was away from school for quite a while and we were living in the Dandenongs there and I had to get on the school bus and I thought, my goodness me, what is going to happen here? You know, school buses have this incredible hierarchy, of course. There's the, you know, the boys up the back, the toughies, the tough girls and boys up the back. You've got the newbies sort of down the front and then you've got the sort of nondescript middle. And I was pretty much in the nondescript middle part. And I had to get on the bus and my face looked really different. And the scars were still really bright red, you know. And I thought, oh, here we go, getting on the bus. And I just walked to the middle of the bus and the entire nondescript middle swiveled to turn to the bullies in the back seat who just shut up and did not say a word and off we went. So I thought that was pretty good.
You became a journalist for a while.
Yeah.
Where did you start?
Started at the Geelong Advertiser. I did a diploma in vocational writing at the Gordon Institute and then I went on to, I think I was even in the first intake of the journalism course at Deakin University and one of my lecturers was the chief of staff at the Geelong Advertiser and he picked me out of the crowd and he said, come and be a cadet. Which was fantastic because I think I was one of the very first women in the Geelong Advertiser newsroom. So I sometimes would walk down, I would walk into the newsroom and I'd hear, wah, 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 wah. Do you know what that means?
I do. Ducks on pond.
Ducks on pond.
Can't talk because there's a woman in the room.
That's it. Then I went to the Sun News Pictorial and I did, you know, various rounds and, you know, whatever.
What was the moment that made you want to leave all that behind, make the insane decision to become a stand-up comedian?
Well, you will remember the era when the comic strip was incredibly popular and we had French and Saunders and we had Rick Mayall and all that. And so what was coming out of England was this so-called new cabaret. So it was quite different and anarchic and all that. So with that in mind, the features editor, she said to me, can you go along and cover this phenomenon that is called the new cabaret? So I duly went off to, I think it was Melbourne University, and the bill was Paul Grabowski playing piano for Steve Izard, David Argue, who was a roller skating, Los Trios Ring Barkus, Richard Stubbs, and then there was a musical group that Gina Riley was in. So I go along and watch this thing, and I go, I had no idea this was happening. I was completely gobsmacked. I thought, that's it, that's it. It was just this incredible moment. So I wrote the story, and within a week I said, I'm leaving. I'm going to be a stand-up comedian. And they were like, what? What are you even thinking?
Right. You're leaving state and national affairs to run away and join the circus.
Yeah. So I went off to work part-time at the Melbourne Times, and with the rest of the time I worked on my stand-up comedy.
And how did you work on that act? Do you become a student of stand-up comedy to do that?
Yeah, I absolutely did. So I'd seen a few of the boys doing stand-up comedy, a little joke above the last laugh, but I hadn't seen any woman do it. And I thought, how would an Australian woman do stand-up comedy? Because I had records of Whoopi Goldberg, and I had records of like Joan Rivers, and I had Lenny Bruce, and I had Woody Allen, and I would listen to these albums and think, oh my goodness, how would an Australian woman doing stand-up sound? And so I practiced and I practiced, and I came up with a little five-minute act, a stand-up act on an open mic night at La Joke. And it was about school lunches and rainbow wax paper and, you know, how you make worms with Vita Wheat biscuits and, all that kind of, very relatable sort of stuff. And everyone said, oh, my gosh, you must be so nervous. You must be so nervous that you're going to go and do stand-up comedy. And I was even standing backstage, and I was the only woman there, and all the blokes are going, are you okay? You must be incredibly nervous. You need to throw up. You need to go for a wee. You know, are you all right? And I'm going, yeah, well, actually, I feel fine. So I walk out on stage, and then the lights sort of hit me. I've been introduced. The lights hit me, and I think, hang on a minute. You mean I get to say whatever I want? I get paid and people listen? Are you kidding? This is the best deal ever. And and for me it was just like, wow, it was just like being struck by lightning. There it was. I thought, this is me.
On air, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
So we were talking before how you'd seen stand-up and you went, oh, my God, this is the best thing in the world, and I'll try it myself. And everyone told you should be worried and you should be vomiting and weeing with nervousness. And it was just the opposite. And it was great. So here's the great paradox of Australian comedy. The scene was very blokey, and certainly the audiences were vile, often vile, to women stand-up comedians. And yet, despite all that, this country, I would argue, pound for pound, has produced an astonishing crop of women comedians.
Are you kidding?
An astonishing crop. Just about most of my favourite comedians in Australia are pretty much all women, as it turns out. Explain this paradox, Wendy. How have women prevailed despite what have been some, a pretty horrible stand-up audience scene in Australia?
Yeah, I wanted to know that too. I mean, when I started out doing stand-up comedy, one of the things was that was said to me all the time, why aren't there more women in comedy? And I thought, well, I'm going to go and find out. So I went and using my journalistic skills, I wrote a book called It's a Joke, Joyce, and I went right back to the vaudeville days and had a look at what was happening there. And what was happening was that women only were really ever given two roles on stage, on the vaudeville stage and in comedy. They were either the very cute little girl in the sort of French maid's outfit.
The sidekick,
Or they were the harridan in hair rollers with a rolling pin, with the man in the middle chasing the little cute thing and the harridan sort of chasing after him. And they were pretty much the only roles. I mean, I interviewed all these amazing women that had been in comedy, names that you'd know are Ruth Cracknell and Jan Adele and
Nolene Brown.
All of them, and that was really a bit of a fact-finding mission for me too. There were women on stage doing sketches and they were never given the script to read. Why would they? They didn't have any lines. And so I think what happened was why there was such an explosion was that Australian women had never been able to cast themselves as characters outside these two very narrow roles.
So you're saying it was a very narrow window of opportunity, but all these brilliant women just went at it.
I think so. I think so. It just sort of exploded, I think. And so we had every stripe of, well, we had the Natural Normans and Sue Ingledon, who were cross-dressing. And then we had Gina Riley doing musical parody. And then we had our group of stand-ups. There was me and Rachel Berger, and then along came Judith Lucy and
Magda Sabansky and all that. Yeah.
So she was the great character actor, of course. So I think we were there all along. We were just waiting for a break in the conversation.
When I met you, that was in the Adelaide Fringe of 86. My group was playing in the same venue as you. You were really nice to us.
Oh,
and you were like, we were a bit in awe of you because you were right up at the top of the tree in the summer. You were right at the apex of the Australian comedy scene. And we were just these spotty newbies from Canberra. And it didn't smell very nice either, for that matter. And you were very nice to us and very friendly and made us feel welcome.
As far as the male-female thing goes, I often say, well, if I hadn't come along, someone would have had to invent me. Because we had to have our own Australian women comedians, didn't we? So I had to be there. And the amazing thing for me, of course, and how lucky I was, is that all the men at the time, they started going, uh-oh, we really need a woman on the bill here, or we're going to look, otherwise it's going to be like a blue sort of blokes night, And so I did get all those gigs, so I was sort of really lucky in that way. A lot of women I read a bit younger than me say that they find the scene very sexist. I honestly, hand on heart, I didn't find it that way. But it could have been because, as I say, I didn't have as much competition and so I sort of got all the plum gigs, I suppose. I'm not really sure.
I think you can debate whether the comedians were institutionally sexist. But there's no doubt about what the audiences were like. Women would walk on stage before they'd open their mouths, you'd be showing your tits.
What you do in that situation, Richard, is you just pick out the ringleader, you humiliate them and all the rest fall into line. It's quite easy. If you're a woman and you're doing comedy and there's a bucks night in, you say, what sort of a bucks night comes and sees a woman comedian? Where's your fiancé right now? Where's she? Is she out with a bunch of bikies or what's going on there? And then all his mates would suddenly realise, oh, yeah, that's right, Robbo. Why have you brought us out to see a woman comedian who doesn't even like us? Who's a feminist? We're leaving. It worked every time, I tell you.
Gee, that's really mean, breaking the heart of a bucks party like that.
I know. I was the first woman ever to compare the London Comedy Store, and by the time I got there, Richard, I could have done Wembley at halftime. I was so practiced in the art of buffheads, Do you remember the tunnel?
I remember the Tunnel Club very, very well.
Rough was that club?
It's the roughest club in the world. Jim Taveray walked on stage for his first gig there ever. Jim Taveray was in the Harry Potter movies, walked on stage. Jim decided he needed a gimmick, and he played the double bass. So remember Jim used to play the double bass and bring it on stage with him dressed as a double bass player. And he came on with the double bass, and he hadn't even gotten to the mic. And someone said at the Tunnel Club said, oh, look, a midget with a violin. Thank you. Good night.
Malcolm Hardy introduced me there. He said, he's a woman, been on TV in Australia, doesn't make her any good. That was his intro. Thank you, Malcolm.
So this brings us now to TV.
Oh, you've got to. Are we not going to tell the big gig story?
I'm just going to ask you that question.
Okay. Yep.
Now, I think I know how the story of how the big gig got started, but I still want you to tell that story about how the big gig came to Australian TV with you hosting the
big
gig.
Well, you will remember that in the year before the big gig started, that you, the Doug Anthony All-Stars, Dame Edna Everidge, and I were invited to London to be on Ben Elton's Friday Night Live because he was having an Australian special. So I'd been talking to Ted Robinson by this stage. He was the director of the Gillies Report, and I'd been on that. And we, you know, we were looking at this amazing explosion of comedy overseas and thinking, oh, how can we do it here? So I brought back the tape of Ben Elton's Friday Night Live, and we were, you know, looking at that. And Ted said, well, I'm going to present this to, you know, the powers that be within the ABC. And he, I said, oh, well, I'll dub you off another tape. So I asked my brother Noel to dub me off a tape. And anyway, they're all sitting around there in the boardroom, apparently. And at the end of our performances on Ben Elton's Friday Night Live, hard porno came on. My brother had taped it over one, the top of one of his porno tapes.
Oh, no. And this was playing in the boardroom?
Yeah, all the executives are sitting there going, huh. And apparently there was silence. And then one of them said, oh, well, she seems to be a pretty good sport.
And they were right. They were right, Wendy. You are a good sport.
Oh, but we did make a lot of changes to the Ben Elton show. The thing that was genius that Ted did, do you remember doing Ben Elton's show? Mm. And the audience was way over there, you remember, and there was a bank of cameras in between. What Ted Robinson did, because he's a genius, he put the cameras right in the middle of the audience.
That's right, and he had handheld cameras, which came right up to the performers, so you could play with the camera and even use it as a kind of a prop for the live comedy that was unfolding.
Yeah.
And it was so much better way to film comedy, as it was sort of, it had that explosive feel then. Mm.
Yeah, that's right. And you were, you know, right up close, and I used to be able to wander through the audience and have chats. It was so interesting, of course, the critical reception for the big gig. I remember, you know, I've had many, many travails with sort of male journalists over the years who, you know, don't like you for one reason or the other. And I remember there was a review of, I think I was in The Age, and the male reviewer there said about the show, oh, and there was Wendy Harmer standing up talking about women's hygiene products and douches. I hadn't mentioned any such thing. It was just this huge projection. There was so much, there was so many men were so scared.
God, did he gotten drunk and turned on a Chemist Warehouse app or something?
I don't know what he thought was going on. But that show really just hit, this will date me, like an Exocet missile.
It did. And I remember after the first show went to air, and it was live, so all the mistakes went in, and there was that feeling of it being a live show that was really quite powerful. I remember walking around the next day, where I live, in Melbourne, and it was amazing. All of a sudden, you go from being completely unknown to this person who's on the telly. What do you remember of that, Wendy, about how, you were already a name on TV, but this made you a star. This made you one of the biggest people in TV at that time.
I remember once walking back to my house in St Kilda, at the time my share house, and there was a fire engine outside the house. And I thought, oh, crikey, that looks like our house. And I got a bit closer and I went, oh, wow, that actually looks like our flat. And I got a bit closer and there was a guy came out in breathing apparatus. And I went, oh, my God, that is my house. That is my... And he said, can I have your autograph, please? I thought, that was pretty famous. But, this is how live it was. Do you remember the night that we were on air and the set was on fire? Do you remember that?
Yes.
And Ted's going, just keep going out of the corner of my eye. I can actually see flames and there's people running everywhere with fire extinguishers. It was too much fun. It was a three-ring circus. Oh, and I don't know whether you ever know this, whether I've ever told you the story. I would be watching you guys, the Doug Anthony All-Stars, and some of the material that you were doing, I was completely appalled. And because I was, you know, I'm a bit of a prude on some levels. And I.
Really?
Yeah, I know. It's hard to believe.
It's escaped me all these years, I must say, Wendy.
But anyway, I went up to Ted and I said, you're not going to let them do that on the TV, are you? And he said, go over there and sit down and shut up. And I went, oh, yeah, right, okay, that's fine. And so I never did that again. But it was a great time.
It was. It certainly was. You moved to Sydney. You left Melbourne, moved to Sydney to host the breakfast program on 2Day FM, and it was very successful for a very long time. I think you did that for 10 years, didn't you, Wendy?
11.
11 years. Yeah, 11 years. You were regularly at the top of the FM ratings, always at the top pretty much.
We won 84 out of 88 ratings good over job. That time.
Well, with that move, is that a bigger move as people might imagine, to go from Melbourne and the Melbourne comedy scene and Melbourne culture, which is very unto itself,
and then
go from that to a big city, Sydney?
Patrick Cook, the cartoonist, has the best line about this. He says the difference between Sydney and Melbourne is, in Sydney, none of your friends will come and see you, but they'll all tell you you are absolutely brilliant, darling. And in Melbourne, all of your friends will come and see you and tell you you're a shit house.
That's about right. I think that's very true. That is very true.
Yeah. Oh, one of the funniest things I remember coming to Sydney and first being on stage and thinking, no one's got any clothes on. It was like everyone had come out in their lingerie because everyone was so beautiful and in bright colours and tan, and we know it was all lovely. And then, of course, the boy that I met was a big, and I'd been going out with these dark, you know, poets and musicians and, you know, all that. And I meet this sort of 6'1" surfy boy with blonde ringlets and bright blue eyes and a tan skin. And Jennifer Burns came to me and said, oh, my God, has he got a brother? She said, I think he got the last single bloke in Sydney. What's going on? Yeah.
So you got married to the beautiful Brendan.
Yeah.
What did you discover after the wedding when you looked at those photos, the wedding photos?
Well, half of them were freeloaders. I had no idea who they were. It was like wedding crashes. Did you know this?
No.
No, that I said to Brendan, oh, here's some snaps of your friends. And he goes, I've never seen them before. He said, here's some snaps. I've never seen them before. So there were people just streaming in and drinking up, apparently. Oh, and there is the ex-boyfriend who came to the wedding, was invited to the wedding, and then slept under a tree at Rushcutters Bay Park. I quite enjoyed that. I thought that was good. That'll serve you right, I thought.
You came back into radio hosting a breakfast program with Robbie Buck on ABC Radio. Was that different to be doing something on the ABC where there's nowhere near as much music and there's so much more to talk about?
Absolutely. You know, I don't think you can fake it on radio. It'll find you out. I mean, especially when you've got a shift that's as long as our shift. And, you know, I think the secret for me for radio is just to be as natural as possible. I mean, do you really, when you meet someone in the street and they say, oh, I've just been down to get the car serviced, you would say, really? Indeed. You don't.
No.
So I just think that you have to be as relaxed and as natural as possible. And, of course, every single day you get off air, you're thinking, why did I say that? You have to pretend that really no one is listening. Otherwise, I don't think you could do it.
Otherwise, you feel like a student being pushed onto a podium at speech day or something.
Oh, well, yes, and you'd be minding your P's and Q's and trying not to offend people, and you can't. There's no way you could. It's be sort of like patting your head and rubbing your tummy for 4 hours a day. I still can't get over the fact that I'm on radio. I find it really amazing.
What do you mean?
I don't know. It's the strangest thing. At least a couple of times a week, I will put on the headphones and I'll say, I'm in radio. I do radio. I'm a radio. How did I get to be? I've always thought the strangest thing is that I've been doing radio as a fill-in while I'm in making other plans. You know, that old saying. Only to turn around and find I've been doing it for 20 years. So it must be actually what I do. I must be a radio person.
Well, this is why I think radio has been so good for you and you've been so good for radio, is because it brings those three strands of your life together. There's you as the journalist, asking the questions, trying to hold people accountable. The second one is you as a comedian, seeing humour and life and fun and play in the language. But the third element, I think, is your background as a country kid. Do you think that's a big thing for you, Wendy? That old-fashioned thing from the country where people are good storytellers, people chat over the back fence. There's a bit of that in the outer burbs in Australia too. Mm. But then that idea that you take people, ideally, you take people as you find them.
Yeah, I think so. Dad was Dad was always like that. He said, "You're as good as any person. I'm as good as any man." He did want me to be Australia's first woman prime minister, by the way. I missed it by that much. But I remember I got him tickets to the Olympics, which was one of the greatest things. And, you know, he loved it and that I was able to do for him. And he got sat next to Henry Kissinger. And he was like, I said, how did that go? Oh, he's, you know, he's all right. You know, he had a few interesting things to say. completely unimpressed.
Don't care much for what you did in Cambodia, just quietly, Henry.
You know, that's right. Yeah. But and every now and then, you know, it is funny, you're interviewing a politician and you do get, as a journalist, you want them, you want to try and pin them on something and you want them to talk honestly to you, and they come in and you call the minister and this and that, and every now and then it occurs, you're like, you're just a person. You're just like, I could be you. You could be me. Why am I standing on ceremony here? I've become a bit better at that, I think, of not standing on ceremony and saying, just talking to politicians like, you know, like my dad would.
I've noticed in social occasions, politicians and comedians gravitate towards each other. The politicians envy the comedians' liberty to say exactly what they think all times, when, of course, they have to hold their tongues, or they should in any case. And the comedians envy the real power of the politician. A comedian will stand on stage and shake their fist at this and that and what's wrong with the world and get us all laughing about it, but they don't really have the power to affect change, and they're a bit envious of the real power the politician has. Have you noticed that? And have you, seriously, did you ever want to be a politician yourself?
Yeah, yes, I did, you know, and I think that that sort of passed me by now. But
well, I think that would have been a terrible thing. I mean, if you'd been Prime Minister, we would have all had a marvellous time. I mean, we would have been laughing, we'd be drunk all the time, and after 3 years we'd find nothing's been fixed, inflation's out of control, I think. we all have enjoyed it enormously.
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I would like to think, you know, that up there at the dispatch box, I would be doing a stand-up comedy routine and everyone, as you say, everyone would be, but could I top Paul Keating? You know, hello, Curly, I'm going to do you slowly. I mean, you know, it's hard to top that.
Have you ever envied politicians their power, though?
Well, of course, I've wanted to change the world, you know, all the time. Don't you think that too? It's not, I mean, I don't envy them their, well, yeah, what can I say? There are a few people who manage to change the course of history, don't they? And especially in politics, there is a particular passion that one person follows, and it can have extraordinary ramifications for the, you know, the fabric of society or climate change or whatever it might be. So do I envy that power? No, I don't. I'm someone who very much believes in, you know, democracy and collaboration. Yeah, I don't envy that at all, but I think it's a very destructive force in society, I think. The Messiah complex. I really worry about that. I really worry about the fact that as a society, we're always waiting for the person who's going to come along and by their sheer dint of will and their vision that they are going to change society. And really, it is just rubbish because, you know what I'm saying, Richard?
I do. I can't stand gurus.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Nelson Mandela, he used to say, if you want to lead, you lead from behind. You push other people out ahead of you. That's kind of the way that you lead. And I cannot get over, and you see on social media, oh, if only we had such and such a person to come and lead us. And you think, well, have a different kind of representation that just doesn't send one person off to Parliament, you know. That, I mean, I would love to see job sharing, for instance, for a local representative. I'd like to see that position turned over regularly. I'd like to see citizen forums. I'd like to be able to send a law back if the majority don't like it for a redo. There's all sorts of ways that I would like to reform the system that we have now, which I don't think it works for us. And the short-termism, a bit more cathedral thinking is what we need, Richard. And our system doesn't allow that.
So build something beautiful. beautiful and amazing. And it takes a century to do so.
Yeah, yes. Yeah.
I think someone who saw your life would say you have a lovely life. Do you think you have a lovely life?
I have a beautiful life. I'm very, very lucky and very happy.
Well, I don't think you think you're lucky. I think you know you've worked very hard for that.
No, I don't think so. No. Well, yes, but I have really been lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time, I think.
You know, you knew where to put yourself, though, to put yourself in the right place at the right time.
Well, I suppose.
You know, like, look out, Bitcoin. Wendy Harmer might be in the middle of that in a moment.
Well, yeah, well, I suppose it's not like I've been sort of struck by lightning and then, you know, swam to shore and then there was, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah,
I suppose that's true. But, yeah, I feel very fortunate and I'm very happy.
Do you think you've come a very long way? And because I think you have. And if you look all the way back to that little girl living in that house, trying to be mum to a bunch of kids, your brothers and sisters, while your dad's not doing so great. There's not much money and the furniture's been taken away.
Yeah.
My word.
Well, I think the bigger arc for me is probably going from having the birth defect that I did from that cleft palate and standing on the kitchen table and Dad teaching me how to read, how to, you know, enunciate. I was a good reader. Teaching me how to talk so that I could recite, you know, from the newspaper, read the newspaper, enunciate. And when I first, on the first night of the big gig, I said, "What did you think, Dad?" He said, "I thought your diction was quite good." And to go from that to being a radio announcer, I mean, that's the thing that kind of gets me. I think, wow, how did that happen? So, I'm pretty proud of that.
Wendy, I've so enjoyed this conversation.
Oh, we have so many stories that we could tell.
Let's do this all over again in a couple of years.
Yes, let's do that.
With all the other stuff that we've left out.
Yeah, that would be great.
Wendy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard, darling.
Wendy Harmer is stepping down as co-host of the ABC Sydney Breakfast Program at the end of this year. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
On days like these, we want to tell you the best story you've heard all week. Each episode of the podcast, we speak to one person about the biggest day of their life, the moment when everything changed. And there's always something you didn't see coming. Days Like These has funny stories.
And he looks beautiful. He's fat and juicy and looking lovingly at the photographers.
Scary stories.
I came to when I was being dragged to a police car.
And everything in between.
I just felt so wrong to leave her there.
And that's when I freaked out. I can't stay in this place. This is terrifying.
And he said, "Oh my God." Yes.
And in our latest season, we bring you tales of a mysterious Brumby, a brush with the Polish secret police, one woman's dream to earn her trucking license, and the power of an illicit love song. Join us on Days Like These. New episodes drop each Wednesday morning, or catch up anytime you like on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.